The announcement says, I'm also embedded on gravity, and it says that the topic of my lecture will be Sunder Vice, which is somewhat surprising. I'm not used to talk that much about myself, but I feel quite happy being squeezed in between strategies for the search of quantum gravity and gravitational collapse. So nothing can go wrong, I would say. Today I will talk about things like topological order, anions, and some, you know, touch upon quantum computation, but indeed knowing that, well, the group of people here I'm talking to is very mixed. I didn't quite know what to do, so I have now a somewhat mixed bag. I will introduce some of the ideas and some of the history very briefly, then I will explain what I think anions are and what the notion of topological order means, very much from a physical point of view. Then we will, at a certain point, enter some aspects of quantum computation, how anions and topological order can lead to a very elegant way of implementing quantum computation. If you only would have media with topological order, you could handle. Then I would certainly like to talk about things that I'm working on now, which are not strictly quantum computing, but it has to do with topological order and breaking, having transitions between topological and ordered phases. And if I realize that some of the people here, or many of the people here, are very much aware of quantum groups and things like that, another way to say it is to break quantum symmetries, and that turns out to have beautiful connections. But as you see, it's the last topic, so I have to be careful. This is a very strange type of history writing here. You see, I'm on top there. But that is a paper I wrote in 1980, and there was a debate, as it Wolf and so on the phase structure of gauge theories. What kind of phases do you have? And so there was, at one hand, there was this idea of confinement. There were Coulomb phases with long-range forces. And there was also this idea that there was a complete Higgs phase. So that was the end of the story. And since the low-energy physics of Higgs phases, where everything was broken, was not interesting, having all the particles were massive, that was the end of it. But then I discussed with him that that was not the right classification. That if you have a complete Higgs, you have a complete massive, all particles are massive, then still in the low-energy physics of that, you could have physical effects, topological interactions. And there would be different phases, and I will talk about them today again, which you can distinguish by their topological degrees of freedom and their topological. So you could say it was the recognition of topological order in ordinary gauge theories which was there. But it was just a rather abstract thing. Then in 1982, there was a famous paper of Wilczek, and a realization that you could have particles with fractional spin and fractional statistics. And that connected up again with that first paper before that. So that took some time to realize. But anyway, there is one line that we get an important paper on conformal field theory, another famous discovery, which is in the realm of condensed matter, is of course the work of Laughlin, where he recognized and understood certain phases, the fractional quantum Hall effect, which is indeed a phase which has topological order. And I will say a few things about it. Now then, the work which continued here started using lots of instruments which basically came maybe from early string theory, conformal field theory, so that fits in between here. And then it was understood that these phases can be perfectly characterized by conformal field theories, and there are many different fractional Hall levels, and each level would be characterized by different conformal field theories. And this is the work of Moore and Reed and Rezaia. They found classifications. So these are all potential descriptions for quantum Hall phases, which are topological phases. On the other hand, the development of topological field theory is related to conformal field theory. It was a very important development. And I was still sitting there, and at that point I kind of understood that I should also try to connect up to topological field theory, and this led to this work here. in 1992 to this very explicit description without conformal field theory of topological degrees of freedom having non-abelian anions, and I gave the full prescription there. And it is this combination here which was basically, I think, the source of Titaev's, because what Titaev observed was, I didn't know anything about it, that actually with all these operations you could build rather perfect quantum computers. And there is this beautiful paper from 1997, born in 2003, as you probably know. So this is a funny way of history writing, but it shows that we are at the interface of various important developments in theoretical and mathematical physics. The idea is that if you talk about topological quantum computing, that you use the idea of non-abelian anions, and I have to explain what they are, to store the quantum information topologically, and also process that information, and you do that by topological operations, namely braiding of these anions. The great advantage is that everything is stored in a global sense, and local perturbations cannot disturb and cannot decohere or influence that system. So that is the most important advantage. So if we succeed in finding phases with topological order where we can easily manipulate these degrees of freedom, these so-called anions, then quantum computation would become very, very within reach. But there's always something, so here you know, I have already mentioned quantum Hall systems, but we know they are very hard to get at and they are very hard to manipulate. So for the moment, it's more a matter of principle than that we now really getting closer to real machines and real computers. So what we need is systems with topological order. These are usually described in topological field theories, and for the moment, it's enough to say it's just a phase, there's a mass gap, so there are no low energy excitations except these topological particles carrying these topological charges and interacting in a topological sense. Now, in the theory, we know quite a few of these. I have already mentioned these discrete gauge theories, as I call them, the quantum Hall systems. And there is some hope, but also, I mean, theoretically, these things you can write down, quantum liquid crystals, spin pneumatics, Josephson arrays, but I should say that in the experimental arena, these are still very modest things. But somehow it is the source of what people like to call quantum technology. So wherever we get to these systems in reality, then many new possibilities come up. So let's talk about anions. And I start always rather simple, because then I hope everybody will follow. For many of you, this may be too trivial, I don't care. So the first thing, the first way of realizing anions refers to particles with any statistics and any spin. And you can, of course, in two dimensions, and we are talking in two dimensions, you can have these situations. So I guess everybody is familiar with the fact that if you have somewhere a localized magnetic flux here in the plane, and you have a charge, and you carry that charge idiomatically around it, then the quantum state describing these two particles will change by a phase factor, and the phase factor should be, of course, a gauge invariant, and that phase factor here, it says, is dependent on Q and phi, namely, is just this gauge invariant path-ordered integral of the potential. And we know what gets out, you get Q times the flux, which is in there, and that's fine. So that is the usual, you could say this is the gauge invariant lone local operator which measures the flux, it's like the Wilson loop, and that's the thing that sets that phase factor. And thereby, I have changed the state by some phase factor, by just moving things. So that's already the beginning. This is an example of a topological interaction, because the B field is everywhere. Yeah, you see? The B field is everywhere zero, so it doesn't matter which path you take, as long as you don't cross this flux, then you get always the same answer. So it is not dependent on the details. If you mark that electron there, that phase factor will not change. So in that sense, it is a global characteristic. You can think of it another way. You can think of this as a composite, and then you can think of this as rotating this object by an angle 2 pi, and then this phase factor would, in some sense, define the spin of that object. And the spin, as you can see, is q phi over 2 pi, which could be fractional. So the possibility of fractional spin shows up. In this theory, of course, fluxes can be combined. Fluxes and charges can be combined to get the so-called dions, or we can add the charges. And so there is this idea that you have some rules which tell you how things can fuse. So there's a set of fusion rules or representations, if you want to say. And there are certain conjugate particles naturally present, anti-fluxes or anti-charges, etc. So these are basic diagrams you can draw in connection with these. Having the basic rules, we can also look at these dions, these composites, like I do here. I have two of these dions, and I can also insert them. So these would be two different species, as far as I'm concerned. And you can see that you get also a property of a monomery getting in around with these two charges. And so if you then go back and say, well, suppose Q1 and Q2 are the same, you have Q5, you can interchange these particles. And you will find that there is a definition of to assign over this interchange property. And you will find that it is exactly the IQ phi again. And so there is, in some sense, even for this fractional spin statistics, a spin statistics connection in this cell. So there is a topological definition of the interchange properties here. And it satisfies the spin statistics theory. These are very much basic of what we call anions. Because these can have fractional spin and fractional statistics. Well, this is well known in two dimensions. The interchanges left or right turning interchanges are distinguishable. You cannot continuously deform them, and therefore, in two dimensions, very important things happen. If you So left over right and right over left, they are not necessarily equal. Or in another sense, if you call that operation tau, tau is no longer equal to tau minus 1. And in three dimensions it is, and so tau squared could be 1 there, and therefore only plus and minus 1, but here you can have many other things. So if you have to keep track, then the state, if it develops, it carries a memory that you have to know what happened to the state. If you have a future state, then the phases will depend on the history, on how you move these particles around. And so this leads to the breakthrough. Go to one and this is probably well known to everybody. So there are free products of these interchanges, but there's only relations you have. They come from the topological equivalence. Like these two diagrams, tau 1, tau 2, tau 1, and tau 2, tau 1, tau 2, they have to be equal because you can continue to deform them in each other without crossing these lines. That leads to the important remark that we have to deal with the breakthrough, and the breakthrough is a group in itself, and you can ask for the representations. Now, you can already see that relation. If you take that relation there, then it clearly, if you have only one dimensional unitary representations, they will be typically of the type I have described, so we have already kind of a physical realization of this particular representation. But of course, if the annuals have a larger dimensional internal Hilbert space, a fixed and I have something bigger, then of course we can think of acting in that internal space, and we get matrices, and we can think of non-abelian straight statistics. And that's what we are looking for, because if we want to store and make quantum computation, we want to make, in some sense, carry the anions in internal Hilbert space, and by moving these things around, we want to make gates, and we want to have unitary transformations implemented on the states, on these internal states. There's another remark. I just made some remarks on the type of structure that you have here. In the introduction, it was already clear that we can also think of ribbons in this case. You could think of the charges and the fluxes, and you can think of this diagram as creating a pair and going with an anti-anion and annihilating them again. And then we have an effect which I also showed, that if you go around, that you get this spin factor, So here you see the spin of particles, antiparticles becomes the same. Another way of denoting that is that there is this particular phase factor that you get. So this is a way to describe it also. So we have some kind of ribbon in the category here. If you have this situation, you can also see that interchange again. So if you have, right, we have two anions there in the middle, you can interchange them, and then you can pull out this thing. Topologically, you will see again the spin statistics equivalent. So that is the very, very basic. The question is then, can we do this also in a non-abelian setting? Now, this is this established work. But anyway, that is the type of phases that were described, and actually, they have. In some sense, they are simple realizations of anions because we don't need all the conformal field theory. So the idea is, yes, think of a gauge theory where you break the continuous group G to a discrete non-abelian circle. Here it is. So in SU2, you can think of the tetrahedral group or D3 or whatever you want to call it. And we have the property that the group elements do not commute. Do not necessarily commute. And we can do the same game. We can have, in that theory, fluxes. We can look at phase factors. But now, of course, we have multiples, and the phase factor can in general be a matrix, namely a matrix representation of a particular group element of this group H. The magnetic fluxes are labeled by these group elements. If you think of it classically, that's certainly what happens. But now, this guy here, in a non-abelian theory, is not quite gauge invariant, because I didn't take the trace. It's not a Fu Wilson operator, but I did that on purpose, because I want to see what happens. Now here, if I go around, I find this factor to be A in H, but now I can make gauge transformations here at this point, and I will get some conjugation of that flux. So what happens is that flux A is maybe not gauge invariant. What I can do is I can apply gauge transformations which work on as a conjugation. And I will get that there is an equivalence relation between these fluxes. And it's clear what I have there. I get the conjugacy fluxes. So thinking of these states, labeling them by elements of the group algebra, so I have vectors labeled by group elements, and I can add them and so forth, linear combinations, then this class is just a space, the internal space, which has a certain dimension. And that would be this internal Hilbert space which we were talking about. So it's clear that the classes are the gauge invariant objects. And I think of them as multiples. I think just of a multiple structure like you have. Well, of course, fusion is then also clear. You have to order these paths in some sense, and then you can decide what the combination is. Since the group elements do not commute, you can write on C as BA, but that is not the same as AB. And so the order in which we do all these things is important. In the end, this leads, of course, to this picture here, that we have classes, and there is a class algebra. So you can again think of representations of these magnetic fluxes, and they have this multiplication. So there is some kind of way of tensoring them together in the classes, but you also see that there can be more classes at the right-hand side, so we get all these properties which are typical for non-abelian symmetries. Interchange properties, well, that's interesting. When you do that, you get a new B prime and A prime, and, well, I don't want to go into much detail, but B prime stays the same in this interchange because it's in front, but the A, it gets modified, and in fact, it gets conjugate. So if I have A and B, and I move them around, then A is conjugated by the element B, and B prime stays the same. So here we see that there is a non-trivial gradient present in these theories, and it's simple to see that that is the case. So in the end, we have here already a very simple theory which has already quite a number of remarkable properties, because as you see, there are all these different classes, and then in the classes I have different states, so this is not easy way to talk about it. And you can, of course, ask yourself if you start grading all that stuff together. And so that is the language we are now looking for. Having these grades and these things, you, as everybody knows, you can, of course, connect up ends and beginnings, and you will end up with some versions of knot theory. And that is, of course, the connection is topological field theory also. And so you may ask, I mean, that's something that I, of course, asked, what are the theories I was looking at? What are they in terms then of all this non-theory and how they're certain invariants associated with this? And the answer is yes. These are the diagrams written in invariants for, well, for topological field theory, and they are associated with this particular phases that are not really related. Yes, that's a good answer. And these are, of course, single loops, but you can have, in our case, you would have forward loops and multi loops, whatever you want. But in general, that situation is there. So, the structure of these topological phases is, in some sense, can be summarized. We have basic fusion rules, like here, and I wrote them down. We have certain combination rules, and that is, in this case, I only took the magnetic part. There's also an electric part to this whole story. I can add the electric charges, but it's more complicated, and I will say something about it. And we have fusion rules, and of course, we have consistency. Not yet the consistency, we can, if we have, you say, the three-point functions define these NABC, these fusion coefficients. And then, of course, if we go to the four-particle level, then we get the definition of these three particle spaces, and of course you can choose different bases, and since they're basically in the same internal space, then it should be possible to transform expressively each other, and there are these famous F coefficients. And you could also say that the associativity now, the associativity of the fusion rules, which is of course something that we always use, that is physically required, that puts enormous restrictions. That condition of associativity translates basically in a relation here, because you can see there are two independent ways to get to the same final state after these F transformations. And so the associativity of the fusion rules is a consistency equation for the whole set of F symbols. Now that is a huge set. This is a hugely overdetermined system. You have you have four externals, so d to the fourth, you could say. You have two internals, so you have d to the fourth equations for d squared typical degrees of freedom. And so this is overdetermined. So this is the first problem. You could turn it around and say, okay, let's start and just find out what solutions are. And actually, that is what some people are now again doing, and doing very consistently. So this is the first half of the story. Then we have also this question of braiding and fusion, and then we have another consistency relation between braiding and fusion, and these are the exciting relations. So this is somewhat more the formal framework which is underlying conformal field theory, but certainly also these topological things. So what we are, I think the mathematicians would call this now categories, and this is then the braided tensor. Tensor is fusion, and it is also written categories. So you have typical class of objects that you can try to classify, like you would classify lead groups or anything else. So to go back to the system of so now we have put that in the framework of, and that creates usually also some algebraic structure, some underlying algebraic structure related with these kind of degrees of freedom. And I return now to to these discrete gauge theories I was talking about. So I had, and so I want to show you what comes out here, that is what is called the quantum double. So there is some kind of pop algebra, and it's a particular structure which is based on this group H, this unbroken group, but it's much more complicated, and that captures the full, say, physical properties of those phases. So this is an important thing. In this case, it is a quantum double group. These quantum double groups also have popped up in 2+1 dimensional gravity, for example, and of course, there are other types of quantum groups popping up in these quantum Hall systems, but the idea is everywhere the same. We have some deformed algebra of some sort. And so I don't know that I should do this, but anyway, to build up that structure, because I know there are some people here who don't know all these things. So the idea of a Hopf algebra is, let's start with the discrete group here. I have some set of elements HI in the thing. So they form a basis for this group algebra, and this group algebra is written here as a product. It's the group product, it's a unit, and then there is a co-algebra. So you have, say, an action of the elements of H on the tensor product. So it's a map from A to A cross A. And so that's something here, that's a particular expression. There's a co-unit, which has to be a trivial representation, and there's an antipode, which for the case of a simple group would be the inverse. So this thing shows that an ordinary group would be already a Hopf algebra because it has all this structure. Now you can look at the double of such a group, that is the functions on the group. Now in this case, if it is a discrete group, functions are just delta functions. They are yes or no, I have that group element or not, so they're 0 or 1, so you get this kind of structure. And functions have also a multiplication, and they have a unit, and so on. And you see now how these things interplay, because the function algebra multiplication involves the co-multiplication on the group, and so on. The co-multiplication on the double uses the multiplication of the group, etc. The co-unit uses the unit, and so on. And the inverse is defined also. So if you have this algebra, then already you have like two Hopf algebras. But now this double construction, which goes back to Grinfeld, and in this particular case, it was Dijkstra, Pasquini, and Walsh, who were in Frankfurt for this time. You can see you can now take the product, say, of A star and dual and A, and then define again all these things, but now somewhat more involved. So I have a basis for those functions times group elements, and I can multiply here this multiplication. The group multiplication is just H1 times H2, exactly what you would expect. But this function multiplication is not trivial. You see, it's not pointwise. You have moved this point. This has been conjugated, this group element. So that is exactly what we need in our system. There is a co-multiplication. So you can look at this as a Hopf algebra now. And then you get some bonus. There are two special things here. First of all, if you look at this structure, there is a central element which commutes with everything here. C is F, it's just a sum over all these things, so it's kind of a, and this is what is called this ribbon element. So you could say, if I have a representation of this, I act with this element that can label the representation, and it labels it by this topological spin factor, or whatever you would call it. And there is a natural R element, which means a thing that implements this interchange property of this breaking element. So that is sitting here, that's in D cross D, and it double times the double, so it's two anions, and it acts according to this co-multiplication of these elements. And that is, so all the ingredients fall into place, that's what I wanted to say. And the representations are now very good. The physics is, of course, the representations. You could say, I came from the bottom up. I had the representations, and I didn't understand what the representations are. But now, now we understand what it is. So the representations have nice properties. And I mention all these things because I think they are very, very generic in the sense of these two-dimensional quantum systems. So it fits very well what we had before. The representation, the unitary representations are exactly labeled by class of the group H times a representation, that's the electric part, it's the electric representation, not of the unbroken group H, but of the pilot conduit. It says it is the class, and then alpha is a representation of the normalizer of an element out of that class in H. So it's small. I can only implement electric charges or dynamos belonging to a subgroup, and now that makes life rather complicated, because it's not just, in the abelian case, it's just Zn times Cn, as we had before, and now it's something more complicated. I have classes, and each class has a particular normalizer group, and so on and so on. But it doesn't matter, because it's exactly what I knew already that was present in the theory, and we have now a nice set of, as you can see, I have a central element, so I can define on all these irreducible representations, I can define this spin, this topological spin property, so that transcends to the non-abelian case. It's written here. And I have a tensor product structure, I have a co-multiplication, so I can make Clebsch-Gordan series, etc., etc. And there is an R element, which is not written out, I think here now, but that's very important. So I have also an implementation for these arbitrary things now of Breakthrough. So this was a kind of an intermediate remark. Where are we? We have particles which are anions. They can be non-abelian, they can have a larger internal space, and they correspond to representations of these, in this case, these quantum double or some other quantum group. I can associate certain spin properties to it, fractional spins. I have fusion rules. I have a braid operation explicit on these guys. And so, furthermore, that's very important, the braid action and the quantum group action commute with each other. So if I have multi-anion states, then yes, I have the structure of the, if I have an N anion state, then it will be a representation, or it will decompose in irreducible representations under this quantum group, and also as representations under the braid group. And so if we occur now non-multidimensional representation somewhere in this discussion that we have on. So the standard statistics theorem cannot be pulled through completely. You get this interesting property that if you interchange here twice two anions, then you will get this factor here that is just twists. But now you see. So here this is equivalent to that, we can just topologically show that, and you will now see that the interchange of these two guys depends on the channel they are in. If they are in a different channel, you get a different phase factor. So it's not possible anymore to assign these properties you need to the individual particles. It depends on the overall channel. So what has this to do with quantum? So I have talked now about anions, I think, and I'm trying to kind of sketch it and say what are important things. Important things were, I think it's summarized already. So now, back to business, and that is, in fact, of course, the art of the quantum knitting, you see. Because what we do is just pull these things to each other. So now we get a little bit of this quantum computation. And now I want to discuss a simple example. I'm sorry that we already have seen this 100 times, but anyway, it's a nice way to see it. Now, we say we have an anion, and the anion has certain brake properties and certain fusion rules. Now, here is obviously the most simple thing you can do. Here is what is called Fibonacci anions, also going back to Wirth, Preskill, Friedman, Brunskill, Wiedemann, of course. But this is a very simple system. You see, you have one object here, this point, and if you multiply it with itself, so you take the tensor product, there are two states, it's the zero and the state itself. So if you think of representations, you can see that this is typically something that you cannot normally get, because if the dimension of this guy is something, you see the dimension of one squared, the dimension of one, so it's not one dimensional, d, if it is d, then d squared is one plus d, which means that the dimension is actually the golden rule. So it's a very funny fact, new dimension. But anyway, this is a consistent fusion rule. Just everything you find. Great matrices with it. And then you can start saying, okay, here in this channel I have two states. So here is the zero state and here is the one state for two. So now you can see that here you have like a two-dimensional Hilbert space. So I did it here, you see. That's why, let's look at this a little bit. Zero times one is one. One times one is either zero or one. And then I can go on multiplying and I get this so-called Bertalan diagram. And I can calculate the multiplicity of states here by counting the number of different paths leading to this point. So here you see in this state I have two. And in these numbers, the dimensionality of the Hilbert space is an increasing number of anions grows like the Fibonacci series. So that's why there's Fibonacci, and you know, if you take the ratios of these dimensionality and you take the limit, you get the golden ratio. So the dimension of these, the quantum dimension of these representations is in some sense related to the asymptotic property, which is described. How fast the dimensionality grows of the Hilbert space if you have many particles and so on. So that is part of that. Now the idea is, if I take three of these anions, I have here three states. So here they are, obviously labeled. In the given basis, I have a three-dimensional Hilbert space. And that is now a space in which we could encode, choose to encode a qubit. Because that is a proposal here by Friedman and Larson. And so what they say is, look, we have here, we have three states. If the total is in the one, then there are two possibilities. And that is where I encode my qubit. The qubit, this we call zero, and this is zero, and this we call one. And there is one non-computational state, not used in external state. But it plays a role in the game. So this would be our qubits here. And so then the question is, what can we do with it? And now the neat thing is that if we see that this is, you see, here is this space, here is this two, which make up the qubit. Now I can use this third one to break. So I can construct the break matrices in this subspace of the qubit. Now, it's hard to read, but there are two elements here, two obvious ones. And one is a rotation, say, around the z-axis, and here this is a more complicated thing. So if you want to know what they are like, here is what they are. If I do it here twice, sigma 1 squared is along the z-axis, I get a certain rotation, which is not, you know, it's like, it's not halfway or anything. And here, the sigma 2 is in the xy plane, you could say. So this is the type of structure that I have realized. You see? By braiding these anions here, I have an action on my qubit, which in the SU2 group of the qubit, you know, which are the operations, the gates, the action of such a simple thing would be exactly doing this transformation. And now here what you can show is that even with this very simple setup, you can already realize, in fact, the full group, because you start off with this. And if you repeat it, you see the downstairs there is the diagram. This is a nice little picture that I stole from Nick Bonesteel, actually. He computed this, so he found all these points. And you see, you fill up this sphere by just repeated braidings. And so if we only talk about one qubit, this would suffice to make an arbitrary gate to an arbitrary position if I go on long enough. So this is a way to illustrate how this topological property can be used to operate on gates, as gates on a qubit. This is not enough to make a computer because on the two level, enough. But anyway, it illustrates at least that aspect. So, now I have two subjects. I will go through some implementation and I will not make it very long because the question is, are there realistic systems and possibly want to go in depth? No, but I want to mention one and then I want to go to the topological symmetry breaking, which I don't know. Mark. So we have this subject is developing, and then the question is, are there realizations that have a chance of really getting something? And to make a long story short, yes, we have already identified that quantum Hall systems in principle would be ideal for this. But quantum Hall systems are what? Quantum Hall system is a two-dimensional conductor, say, and you put it in a on the surface or in the interface, you have free electrons moving, and you put an enormous magnetic field transfers to the plane, and then certain weird things happen. You get the Hall effect, because the magnetic field, strangely enough, if you put the voltage in this direction, then the current will go perpendicular, because there is this strong magnetic field. And so you can then, you get a transverse component to the conductivity, and that's what is going on here. And then it turns out that if you have the magnetic field such at a certain density of electrons and a certain magnetic field, then if there is a so-called filling fraction there that is defined by the number of electrons divided by the number of fundamental flux units, think of the thing I was doing in the very beginning, then you get some particular quantum fluid in which these fluxes and charges start binding into dionic states, and those are the guys that are the anions we are talking about here. So then there's a phase transition. You get a new state of matter, and that was the great discovery of our friend Laveran. So we get an incompressible quantum fluid, and the excitations of that medium are things that have fractional charge, and therefore fractional charge with flux, they become anions. So the first one was, so what happens if you put an electron excite, you throw that in there, then it will split in some sense in these quasi particles. In the simple case of Laughlin, these carry charges one e over 3 for the filling fraction 1/3. So this was the beginning of the game, and here you have the anions in some medium. Now, since then, this fractional quantum Hall effect was quite academic, because you have to operate by the 50 or 20 millikelvin, and it's all very, very, very delicate stuff. But in the meantime, people have certainly discovered. So here would be the normal classical picture. You see, when you increase the magnetic field, this conductivity would increase. This transverse, but now you see it levels off. You get these plateaus. These are these quantum Hall plateaus where the transverse conductivity is some value, and the longitudinal one goes to zero. So this is typically the quantum Hall effect. And there are many of those plateaus, and some of these plateaus, and each plateau has a different conformal field theory associated with a different set of anionic excitation. For example, here is the next one, or not the next one, here's an important one. This is called the Moore-Reed state, and it's associated with the quantum group there. It's SU2 level 2 times some other part, but it's not pictured here, SU2 level 2, which is a well-known quantum. And the particles have E over 4, and it's not sufficiently rich to do universal quantum computation. If you go even further, then you get the 12/5. These are, it's the lowest of the Reed-Riesz-Ayer. The whole topological properties were analyzed by Stunden and myself. And here we are on the level SU2-3, and this is sufficiently rich to build universal quantum. So the question is, can you do this? Can you make this? This is incredibly hard. The phase has been recognized, that it's certainly there, but doing experiments is not so simple. So here, well, let me not go on, but here's again this kind of diagram, is the dimensionalities, and here are the quantum group properties which allow you to determine all these great rules and how you put in principle build a quantum computer out of this. And the idea would be to have such a phase, you see. I mean, this is another question. Now you have to make little islands where you put these anions, and then along the edge you have other anions going around, and they can jump over, and in that sense you implement these rules. But here is a tool. You see here there are two anions. I have some. This is like a qubit, and then I can go through here. I can put a little voltage here, and they jump, and then you will go to another state. So that would be the idea. And in fact, people are really working on that in these field experiments. In reality, I don't want to report on that. This is again a picture of a very early paper of us where you actually show that this is happening. So, so I have talked about topological order and how it can be used to do quantum computation and how it can be characterized by certain quantum groups or some things of that sort, tensor categories, and so forth. And now I want to talk a little bit about some ideas that I have been developing over the last years, and let's call it topological symmetry. And the idea isn't another. And the idea is, in some sense, simple. It's almost what a physicist would do. And how did I get to it? You see, if you have SU3 level K and you have SU2 level K, then maybe you think there is a way of embedding SU2 quantum groups in SU3 quantum groups or something of that sort. Naive as a physicist, you think, okay, let's look at it. How does this work? And it doesn't work at all. There's nothing of that sort. So then you start thinking about, how can I learn what is really happening? Then you do symmetry breaking. Because symmetry breaking is a physical means to find out. You say, I have a particular symmetry structure, I condense something, and then I will see what the leftover physics is, and that will tell me what is, how these structures are related. And that's what we are going to discuss here. So, yes, and then in these systems it's kind of interesting. So you know the symmetry breaking, you know, normally with the Higgs or whatever, that's all symmetry breaking. You go from SU5 to SU3 to SU2 and U1 and so forth. SU2 to U1 to U1. These are typical electric cases, and you always go to a subgroup. Here that doesn't work. So we have to figure out what is going on. So we have now all these properties here, and the idea was to see whether we can relate topological phases by some kind of symmetry. The mechanism is that we associate, we look for an order parameter again. And now the notion of an orthogram is extended because we have talked about anions, and they are representations of these quantum groups. So I take an element out of a representation of the quantum group and I say, okay, throw it in the vacuum. This is has a non-vanishing vacuum expectation value. What does it mean? So then we have to do the following things, and we encounter some interesting questions. That's why I would like to talk about it, and I also would like to talk about it because I know a lot of people who work on quantum groups in completely different contexts as I do, for example, in the gravity case, and I have not looked at this at all in the gravity case, so this would be maybe an interesting topic to talk about. So let me say how it goes. As usual, we think of some representation or some vector in the representation. There, we call it phi naught, in some representation pi of phi at this point. And we want to assume that there is a condensate, so there is a vacuum expectation. Now then you have already a few things. Since the spins are not integer, or they don't have to be, we have to pick out certain channels which are bosonic, otherwise we cannot make such channels. And to think of a condensate in a constructive way, we have to require that state breaks trivially with itself, which is also not possible. So you have to check that. Otherwise it doesn't make sense to talk about a condensate. So these here are two requirements. And you can make that even more precise. And then we can start off and we can say, well, what is the algebra which leaves that vacuum invariant? That would be the unbroken. That would be the so-called circle. Here is the requirement more formally done because you don't know what you mean otherwise. This is an element A of that quantum group. And if it acts like the co-unit, because that is in principle the way you have to formulate it, it is like a trivial representation, this should act as a trivial representation under all the elements, and then those A's which have this property, they define the subalgebra. So that's simple enough. That algebra is a subalgebra, and you can start looking at it. But that algebra is nasty. That has not the nice properties that the original algebra has. So there is some problem. So it is not necessarily anymore an algebra. And then you have to think again about the physics. Why is it not true? And then you see, you can understand it. Let's see. It's probably there. I hope you can follow this kind of reasoning. But I do what I would normally do in ordinary physics context. I would say we have representations of this algebra T. The algebra is there, so I have representations. And T is a subalgebra of this double I have, to start off with, let's say constant double. Then I have the original representation of the big one, and they branch, they have branching rules into representations omega of this subalgebra. Standard. Branching rules. But now, what is interesting is the following. If I have a condensate, it's called phi r here, and then I can ask whether the state in the condensate has trivial rate relations with the other representations. So the picture is this. So here is my condensate. All over this, and now I throw some of these particles in. One of the particles in some T representation or in the original. Now suppose that particle would not have trivial grading with this particle. Then there's a problem. If I now carry the vacuum around, let me characterize the vacuum by this arrow. If there's a non-trivial grading, then I can carry the vacuum around. And it will not close. There is a transformation on this vacuum back here, and there is no way to get it right. And that's also why the algebra is no good, has not the good properties, because there are objects now which disturb the vacuum in an essential way. And now we have to turn it around again. What does this mean? It means there is at best, there is a wall. There is a domain wall in two dimensions connected to this wall. This particle will carry an infinite energy and an infinite medium. It is confined. So this is what this particle is getting. So we find that certain particles, types, which have non-trivial grading relations here, will be confined in the Brocken phase. So it takes care of the two-dimensional confinement. And that is all necessary. Then you also expect that there is no good description anymore because I have representations which have strings and other representations are points. And of course that is not a nice algebra with simple grading relations and anything like that. So that is the reason that we didn't get something nice. But now we also understand what it means. I mean, it means basically stuff, so there is a wall. And so we have confinement, so we can think of objects like that can exist. Maybe you get some hadronic type pictures. And you have free particles. Let me not do this example. So now, it's also clear that if there are surviving particles there, anions, they, if you tensor them together, if one is a non-confined product, is also non-confined. So they do form a decent, again, Hopf algebra type of thing, a braided set. And so you can then say, okay, after we remove the confined particles, then we have, again, a good structure, a good topological effects. Another way to interpret the confined particles, by the way, is if you have a boundary on your system, you can think of the degrees of freedom which are confined to be put out to the surface. So they become boundary degrees of freedom. And so this is, I think, is a very nice picture that comes out of it. So here, summarizing this part again. And so here we have the quantum loop we started off with, I think is the EH, but later on we also do this for other things. So we have the error representation. Those give me all the anions. I make a condensate. I get the intermediate one. While I could still say representations are certain degrees of freedom in the intermediate phase, but then I have this other criterion of confinement, which is based on the braid properties, and I will find that there is an unconfined algebra U. And in fact, those classify the degrees of freedom, the anionic, in the broken phase. The other ones are confined. And there are walls, and I can also characterize the walls in an invariant way by this kernel of this map and that has representation. So the whole picture seems to fit together very nicely. That's one view on this subject. And now I want to do one thing as the last that I would like to do. This carrying this idea further into conformal field theory type context. I think that is very nice because, as we said already, conformal field theory, we have also quantum groups associated with them. For example, HP3 at something level K. What is happening if I find bosonic condensate? What does it do? What is that other group that is left over? And now we find an interesting connection with conformal field theory. For the people who are into that, I think it's kind of a surprise. So let me do it. And now we use also the language of the representations. As you know, you have the group. I did now discuss the breaking of the group, but you can also immediately go to the representations. You can also analyze symmetry breaking on representation level only. You say, I have such and such representation, and I let them branch. And if you have the branching rules, then you also know everything about the embedding. So this is another way to talk about it, as a very elegant way. And so there's some paper coming with Joost Slingerman and myself. So then we just say, well, you have certain representations on the high level, A, and you split them into other representations. One of them you call the vacuum, identify, and then you have these branching rules, and they should be consistent. Now, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you an example, because that is much more fun. Here is an example, SU2 level 4. I don't know if you all know that. That is the quantum group, which has five representations, the trivial one, doublet, the triplet, the quartet, and the quintet, and there is nothing else. And you have a closed ring, a closed representation. So here it is, you know, 2 times 2 is 1 plus 3, and so forth. So we all know this, but it is truncated. And the quantum dimensions of these representations are now, you see, are real numbers. And the conformal weights, or these spins we were discussing, they are also here. So this is the data, and if I know this data, I basically know the branching, most of the rules I can apply. So you see that these dimensions come out of these truncated multiplicities, these dimensions fit. You can just multiply these numbers here, and they will all fit again. So this is the typical circuit. Now, is there something? Yeah, here's an interesting guy. It has spin 1, so this would be some guy that could condense, and it is a non-trivial representation. And so I could say, let's condense it. That's what we are going to do. And what I really say then is that, let me see. So in some sense, I say that the 4 is then to be identified as the 5. That's what I say on this level. So 4 becomes equal to 0. Now then you can already see that you get all kinds of funny things. 1 times 0 is 3. So 1 and 3 have to be identified. 2 times 4 is 2, that doesn't mean 3 plus 4 is 1. So you get identification. So in this new phase, you cannot anymore distinguish the 1 and the 3. So there is all kinds of stuff going on. Now this is the analysis. And I'm not going to, it just comes out of these fusion rules and demanding that they are consistent again with the original fusion rules as I showed in the first picture. And then is the result. I have 5 representations. Now the 0 and the 1, the 3 becomes the 1, so the 3 is gone, it's just the 1. The 4 is gone, that's the vacuum. And the 2 has to split in 2 representations. Because otherwise there is a problem, you can see it. 2 times 2 is 0, plus 2 plus 4, but 4 is 0, so I have twice the vacuum in the product of representations, it means that representation has to split. And I can calculate the fusion rules. So I have a new algebra there, and so the question is then basically, what do I find? What is this then? So, okay. We have to make sure that we do the confinement step. And if we do the confinement step, we have to make sure that, in this representation context, it's slightly differently formulated, works all the same. We will find that one of these particles is actually confined. So we have the 1, the 0, the 2, 1, and the 2, 2. And if we now go and see what we are left with, we have only the 0, so the 1 gets confined. It doesn't have the right great relations with this 4, which is talking about. Which is.
I'm sorry, I have a question. So I don't understand what the splitting is and why. I couldn't check all those relations.
No, of course you couldn't.
2 sub 1 equals 2 sub 2 equals 0 is also a consistent solution. That's not true.
There is one solution where you put everything equal to 0 and then
means
there is nothing left.
Right.
What we do is, of course, we start out by looking for more interesting solutions. So let me try to explain that somewhat more. We have some certain conditions on what possibly can convince. Now, in this theory, there is only one field which has spin 1. You see, so that is the only one I can do. So there's a unique answer here. If I want to do what I want to do, I can only do this. And I do get the consonants, and it's just a machine. So I do the consonants, and it's just cranking through the equation, through the branching rules. You get scared by this, I understand. And let's not go through the details. There was one thing I pointed at you, and that was this one. This is the original rule for the three-dimensional representation. 3 times 3 is 1 plus 3 plus 5. It's the way we do it normally. Mm-hmm. But now, the 5 is identified with the vacuum. It's condensed. Yeah. So now it says 3 times 3 is the singlet plus the 3 plus the singlet. And then you see that there is twice the singlet.
Oh, I see.
And if I have twice the singlet, there's a unique vacuum. Okay. That means that there are, in fact, two components, each of which can map to the vacuum.
Okay.
It's a little bit so it's very important. That is why I have to split.
Okay.
That's why I have to split. And then I can deduce these rules. So this is the algebra T. It's a perfect algebra, but it has a confined particle in it. So it has not good brain. And what we are left with is only 2, 1, 2, 2, and 0. And these are the fusion rules. Now these fusion rules I recognize. And now the answer comes. So what was it? What is the subgroup of SU24 which is there? Realized. This is a unique algebra. I know the weights, the quantum dimension. I can look it up in the book. Here is the answer. SU3. Level 1. So the SU3 level 1 algebra in some sense is contained in SU2 level 4. So you might find this strange, and I thought also it was strange, but then something became clear to me. And that's the concluding remarks a little bit. because this goes a bit further. But now, for the people who are somewhat more familiar with this, you see, I know what this is. I know I have seen this before. In fact, this has to do with what in conformal field theory has been studied. Conformal field theory, this is well known. It's called a conformal embedding or a wave. It's a special case of what is called the coset construction. And what is the coset construction? So let me give some philosophy now. This is kind of interesting. We have these Bessemino Witten models. They are models with a big chiral algebra, the Kac-Moody algebra, SUn level k, for example. And they have fusion rules. And the fusion algebra is this quantum group SU2,4. So these two things belong together. Now, let me try to explain one thing. In conformal field theory, you have the conformal structure, or the extended conformal structure that is called the chiral algebra. It has some representations, primary fields, and the primary fields have fusion rules which are governed by this quantum group. It's the horizontal, it's on top. It's not part of the chiral algebra, it's exactly the extra piece. So now you start understanding what's happening. If I make the horizontal group smaller, then the chiral group has to become larger in some sense. At least that's very much compatible, because it's in some sense the commutant of what is in the quantum group is the chiral. Now this is a chiral. This is a conformal embedding, where you can say, if you take the SU2,4 representations and you throw a few out, then you get degenerate representations, and if you add them up, you get exactly the SU3 ones. So that, in some sense, the chiral symmetry can increase while the quantum group becomes, in that sense, smaller. And so what we now found is the following. And then I should, because this I don't want to do anymore, but the conclusion is what is said here. We had all these Bessemino-Witten models, and then there was this thing, the coset construction, and I don't have to go in detail on this. It were attempts to make models with larger extensions of the conformal symmetry. So that was something that was trying to find all rational conformal field theories. That was the whole problem of this coset construction and more or less. It was just a technical device to try and make new conformal field theories. And we succeeded, and many of them were discovered. Now, what we have shown here is a very general result, that there is a physics to the coset construction. The physics is exactly what I have described. I take a quantum group, I do a condensate, and then I will find that the resulting theory can be predicted, so to say, by the coset construction. So it's like a new and physical interpretation of this whole structure of conformal fields. So here was an example. There's an amazing model. Let me not discuss this. Now you get all. This was a quantum Hall system. I want to summarize. And I went over time. I'm very sorry. So I think what I have tried is to show that topological ordered phases in condensed matter are actually important and interesting. Non-abelian anions provide a means to implement quantum computation, if we could only do it. Quantum groups, Hopf algebras, are natural ingredients of two-dimensional quantum systems. And then, the remarks of topological quantum computation, since it's all global and it's only related, and moving these guys around each other at arbitrary distances, this effect of decoherence is very much suppressed, exponentially suppressed in principle. In fact, we only have the quantum Hall systems to play with, and there is a lot of activity now in experimental quantum Hall of them, because this is a new relevance to these systems, and there is a lot of effort in this direction. But maybe you should also look at other systems. The condensed matter physicists were not used to look for these phases, but now maybe you will find them in typical pneumatic spin systems and what else. We have exploited the connections with topological quantum field theory conformal. And this breaking of topological order links different topological phases, and it is also, it points maybe at why we don't see certain phases, because there is this channel in which the condensation can take place, and you go maybe from one to the other, like in the extended topological symmetry breaking with non-integer quantum dimensions can be done. And that is the relation with coset construction. We had to go at the common law systems, and I mentioned here breaking of two-dimensional gravity, maybe something that's an item on my hand. So, I think I should leave it with this. Thank you very much.
Constructions and 3+1 stable considering membranes and their topological properties.
Well, yeah, you see already that originally the discrete gauge things were all three-dimensional. I just looked at the fluxes. And this topological symmetry theory, in my opinion, is exactly a situation where, yeah, you should say some string condensate is there, and then the other ones will get membranes, physical membranes, and they will collapse. That is my interpretation. So yes, I think you can also, I think you can look at what it would mean for higher dimensional situations. Yes, it would be relevant. That's my idea. I haven't thought of it. I haven't worked on it.
Does there exist some physical situation where you could have this painting already in a 3D, not in 2+1, but in a 3+1?
In 3+1, whether I know. Oh, yes! Yes, actually. But it's not the quantum. Non-commuting defects are well known in condensed matter. If you have condensed matter systems, really classic. You see, I showed you already in the beginning that it's a classical breaking also. Now, so I can, for example, ask whether I had a, a disclinations and dislocations. One is a translational defect, and the other one is a rotational defect. It's also with two-dimensional gravity, you have exactly the same stuff, because the particles are exactly that kind of defect. And they have non-abelian breaking relations. So yes, indeed, it is true. If you have a dislocation and you bring it around the disclination, then the dislocation will have rotated and it will go in another direction. Actually, that is exactly right. So there are examples where classically it is realized. And pneumatics is a beautiful example. I have a student working on this. Suppose that you would have quantum pneumatics, meaning that it can be a linear combination, because that's basically what you do. If there is a vector space, and you can just build states on that. That is called, I think, quantum pneumatics is that is called the condensed matter. Then you could have all these situations as well. And so we have worked out here in all kinds of examples of that sort. But quantum properties, the systems, it's all. The ones I know are classical, there it's obvious. Quantum realizations of anions, and that is typically only, as far as I know, the quantum Hall systems.
I have a last question.
Yeah.
Okay. This can be very speculative, but if you look at the fractional quantum Hall effect,
yeah,
and in the vacuum in which an electron decomposes into three fractionally charged particles, is there something like an inverse fractional quantum Hall effect? And can you put those excitations, those fractionally charged anionic excitations together, make things that look like quarks, say, rather than electrons? If they have fractional charges, maybe you could put them in other combinations.
Yeah. Let me understand.
So could you make something which is a fermion, but still has a fractional electric charge?
You can sit, in other parts of this thing, you can have certainly. A fermion is a fermion, right? A fermion with a fractional charge in this system.
Yes.
Yeah, that must be possible. Yeah, because if you have semions, you can in principle bring, semions have half a fermion. So if you bring two of them, then they don't have the full charge of it, they have half the charge. And they still are, will be a fermion. Yeah, so
so could you make a little simulation of a PCB?
But it's two dimensional, yeah?
Yes, still.
yeah, well. I don't know what that would mean, right? I mean, this thing is confinement, which I am showing, yes.
It's like a two-dimensional, dynamic mimic things, whether I not have exactly the right content, I don't know, but that certainly would be possible. Actually, let me say that also, I have students who has put this on the lattice, these theories, again, these discrete ones, because that is somewhat, it's not all too complicated. And so what we did is we had many parameters in those actions, and so you start goofing around in parameter space, and you will indeed find all these condensates. So they are all there. For each conjugacy class, there's a different type of corner, and you get these confinement phenomena, etc. So you have order parameters, like Hof loops and Wilson loops, and you will find that they have the appropriate behavior area perimeter law. The perimeter law, that's what I should end.
That's nice. And I'm curious.